Welcome to the second hour's readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org. Good afternoon. Once again, this is Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas on Friday, April 3rd, 2020. Earlier this afternoon, actually just a few moments ago, Governor Abbott wrapped up a press conference he gave in Dallas relating to the coronavirus. We are going to play that for you. It's going to take most of our hour of the second newspaper. Once that ends, we will bring you back to readings from the local newspaper for the rest of the time we have. Here's the governor.
In bedrooms that would accommodate such expansion. Also, I have made some waivers that will increase staffing. Some of the examples would be waivers that will allow nurses and our doctors to come in from out of state and be able to provide their medical services here. Waivers that would allow those who are recently retired doctors or nurses to be able to get involved again. Other different types of waivers to ensure that we are expanding our medical staff as much as possible. The results of this is, if you see that bottom line and then going to the next slide, is a 142% increase in available beds in the state of Texas. So if you look at the far left column, that's dated March the 18th. It shows as of that time in Texas, we had 8,155 beds that were then available. As of today, we have 19,695 hospital beds available if they were all needed to treat people with COVID-19. And so on this next slide, it shows the total available beds as we speak today, the total number of reported beds that exist across the state of Texas, the percentage of beds in Texas that are vacant right now in the event that they needed to have someone occupy those beds who contracted positive for COVID-19. Importantly also, we have more than 2,000 ICU beds that are available, and a lot of people have been interested in finding out about. We've identified 8,741 ventilators that are available to be used for those who may need them because of COVID-19. Now I want to pass the presentation over to Dr. Zerwas. So as I mentioned earlier, we have created this strike force that's worked on supply chain, doing things like trying to procure masks and gloves and face guards, things like that, things that are identified as personal protection equipment. In addition to that, we needed to have a strike force also work on the supply chain for hospital beds, as well as doctors and nurses. And there's no one better to help do something like that than to bring in a doctor, and especially someone who is a former legislator, especially someone who was chair of House Appropriations, and that is Dr. Zerwas. And so I would like to turn over the presentation to Dr. Zerwas to explain more about what he's been able to achieve and kind of where we are as a baseline right now and where we may be going. Doctor?
Thank you, Governor, and thank you for the bold actions that you've taken, because I think the numbers are going to reflect the fact that you're positioning Texas into a very good place. This slide kind of shows how we categorize the availability of beds out there. The beds that the governor has referred to already and that I will run through in this presentation are all in the level 5 green box. If you were to walk into a hospital today, there would be beds there, there would be equipment there, and there would be staff there, nurses, other individuals who take care of the patients. That's what's in level 5. That's what we have as of today, and it's actually, in terms of an availability of that, the over 19,000 number is exactly what we have now as a consequence of the actions that the governor has taken. Level 4 is where we want to surge into. This is not a number that's reported anywhere. And I want to do a shout out to the Texas Hospital Association and all their members for working with me to help get some of these numbers that would actually give us an idea of what other beds within the four walls of a hospital, if you will, that we could actually surge into. In other words, we could open these beds up if we could provide staff, And if we could provide the actual hardware and things that needed to make that a bed, what would that number be? And today we finally got that number. We can increase our bed capacity by 7,600 beds just by doing that. These are beds that are ready to go. They just need people to staff them, and they need some of the equipment to make them functional. Also within this same surge capacity is ICU. And as we know, a number of these patients develop a very severe type of pneumonia. It's called adult respiratory distress syndrome. They require ICU care at that point. And we can actually add 2,200 ICU beds by surging into certain areas that could be turned into that. And that doesn't include some of the areas that could function as an ICU that I'll mention in the level three there. And when you double up, by virtue of the waiver that the governor granted, we can add another 2,200 beds in that area. So you're looking right there, and then there's a whole hospital up in El Paso that's ready to go, that's not occupied yet, that could add a substantial number of beds there. Over 10,000 beds just in that category, level four, right there can be added. And if you use the level three, we start talking about, okay, we want to use beds differently. And so if you look at a post-anesthesia care unit, which is where I spent a lot of my life, of course, those are essentially ICU beds. They function just like an intensive care unit would if the nurse is right there by the side taking care of them. It provides for all the invasive monitoring, all the ventilator equipment that you need can be functioning in that way. And in addition, an operating room, frankly, can be used the same way. All operating rooms have an anesthesia machine in them. Most anesthesia machines have a pretty sophisticated ventilator on them, which is not in the number that the governor mentioned. And so those can be turned into capability also. That's not a number that I have right here at hand with me, but that is certainly something that can be advanced as you move forward. When you move into the next level, then we're talking about getting outside of the walls of the hospital. That's the ambulatory surgery centers, the freestanding ERs, the long-term acute care hospitals, LTACs we call them. Even some of the nursing homes could be used. These are places where people are taken care of. The equipment is there. A lot of times the staff is there also. And so those are things that can be done. And by virtue of some regulatory relief that was given, the hospitals can actually reach out to these places and run those under their license during this crisis period. And then finally, level one, and I'll mention that as I close up here in just a minute, is the things that we'll look at that are pretty non-traditional. These are your hotels and your motels. They are your hospitals that perhaps the federal government has come in with or the military has come with and stood up. These are places where typically you'll send patients when they're either not requiring a whole lot of extra care or they're actually getting over an episode of COVID-19 and on the way out, but they don't require the extraordinary support that a hospital in this type of situation would require. So let's walk through a few of these. I just want to unpack the slide that the governor showed in terms of the whole statewide effort. These TSAs are trauma service areas, and we operationalize the trauma service areas through something called RACs. And so these are the things that actually in different areas of the state that provide for the care that you're going to see here. And so as you can see, the percent available beds in the Dallas-Fort Worth area is 33%. The numbers are there. The details of the numbers are there. I don't want to necessarily go over those, but the percent available beds is a third. Not too surprising. Similarly, in the next slide, in Houston, 33%. Significant number of ICU beds. If we move up to Tyler, about 37% of the beds are available right now to take a patient. So if you got kind of real busy with COVID patients up there, they'd have a significant number of beds available. If we move to El Paso, 63% of the beds are actually available there. And then there's some additional beds that I mentioned as I was going through the different categories. TSAA Amarillo has about half of their beds available, 51%. Abilene area, 64%. Similarly, quite a few beds available there. And down to the Laredo and Rio Grande Valley, just around 38% of the beds, 99 ICU beds are available. San Antonio, just under half of their beds are available, and about 400 ICU beds are available. And again, these are all as a consequence of the actions that, the governor took in order to create that capacity. You know, initially the effort was to preserve PPE, and by shutting down the elective procedures and the elective surgery, PPE is being preserved, but at the same time you're generating very, very significant capacity. So once again, that's the stuff that's in the green box. And in Austin, about half of those beds are available also, along with 153 ICU beds. So let me just come back to the slide that I was showing the different categories in and just reiterate. In level five there, in the green box, was all the stuff I just told you about. It didn't include level four, didn't include level three, where you're using things in a different way. Didn't include level two. We didn't speak to anything of the other alternative types of care sites that might be outside that we could actually move patients into to take care of them. But level one is the area that there can be some very, very significant opportunities for us. These could be hospitals that perhaps have been closed up for some reason, and they need to be sort of reinvigorated and brought back online for a short period of time. They can be the hospitals that are set up by the military. We've seen some of those in New York. We actually have about two of those set up. We have one up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area called FMS, Federal Medical Stations. 250 beds that are up there in the K. Bailey Hutchison Convention Center. There's actually, similarly, about that same number of beds set up in the Freeman Coliseum in San Antonio. And then Houston will be setting one up in NRG. That doesn't include the numerous number of hotels that are available out there. The hotel-motel industry has really come forward and saying, look, we're here to help you. You know, if you need to use our facilities, let's see what we can do to make those happen. And so that's what you're going to see in kind of the level one. And again, at least it's our vision that these are probably going to be settings where patients are getting over their condition. They don't require the really high level of care that you're going to see in the hospitals and in the intensive care unit settings. The next slide shows just kind of what are some of those potential care facilities that you see. There's over 100 of them marked on this map, and they're separated out into eight regions that we use in terms of determining our hospital program preparedness. I put that up there just to show you there's a lot that can be looked at out there. We utilize the Corps of Engineers, Texas military to go and do an assessment on these things in terms of what it would take to actually bring them up. And then if we look at the final slide there, the state and local surge capacity, this is, again, the eight regions that are marked out in that previous slide that you have there. And you see state and local. The state will work to set up some type of care in these level one facilities, typically a hotel, and we would work with somebody to provide the necessary staffing in order to take care of patients in that setting. Locally, in your local health departments and other folks will also work in order to provide some of the care that's necessary there. And this is, I believe, back over, Governor, about 3,000, I believe, is what this would ultimately result in terms of additional areas that people could be taken care of. We put some pretty conservative numbers in here, but this can actually ramp up pretty fast by people just opening up different facilities for people to be cared for.
Great. Well, yes, sir. Thank you, Doctor, for the presentation, but also thank you for the work of you and your team that you put in to make sure that we would have all those resources available.
Absolutely. I'd just say, Commissioner Hellerstadt and the Department of State Health Services have been fantastic in doing this work, creating the organization around it, and really deserve a great deal of credit for that.
Speaking of which, I would like to turn things over to Dr. Hellerstadt.
Thank you, Governor. I really wish that everyone out there could see the team of public health, emergency management experts, Texas military forces, the governor's strike force, and the many others who have come together to work around the clock 7 days a week to prepare for and prevent COVID-19 in Texas. I can assure you that our teams are thinking of you too. Protecting the people of Texas, our neighbors, our friends, and our families is the heart of our mission. I have a question. When is a disaster not like a hurricane? It's when you can change its course, and we absolutely have the ability to change the course. Preparation, and you've heard about the amazing preparations that are out there from Dr. Zerwas. Preparation is necessary, but prevention is really the key. And prevention is what will change the course of COVID-19 for the better. We Texans are eager to prevent COVID-19. We see the evidence everywhere we look. We see the things we are doing to protect each other. We are looking for ways to measure the benefits of that cooperation and I believe that benefit will be large. We should reward each other with what I would call random acts of compliance, and we can always give the corona wave to say thanks. Our success and the visible signs of our community spirit should give us courage to continue to do what we must do to win this war. We must continue to both prepare and prevent until the crest of the wave has passed over us. Then we can figure out how, with all due care, we can resume the life of liberty and prosperity that we will find waiting for us once the coronavirus has passed. Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Doctor. And now, Nimkit.
Thank you, Governor. Three things to talk about today. One is personal protective equipment. We continue to work with our federal partners, our private suppliers, but really the most exciting piece for me right now is the innovators that are out there. We've had a lot of homegrown organizations come forward, private sector businesses with new ideas and new ways to produce personal protective equipment. We're looking at them, working with our healthcare partners to see what matches, and I think that will have a big expansion to the way that we protect ourselves in the future. The second is, Dr. Zerwas mentioned, is the surge capacity pieces. And I want to thank all of those that have offered their resources to us, and I also want to assure all of our local government partners, we will be working on this with you. You will not see the state set up an organization in your community that has not been fully vetted and cooperated with your local elected officials and your local public health authorities. And third is to continue to follow the rules and follow the plan. This is the best possible outcomes we can achieve. Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Nim. To close it down before questions, a couple of quick comments. I want to pick up on a couple of things that you all mentioned. I do want to emphasize what Nim Kidd was talking about, and that is we've been overwhelmed with offers of supplies and volunteers to help. And this is the way that Texans respond, and we are so proud and so grateful for everything that is being offered up. And please know that your offers of help are being coordinated within everybody in these offices. And keep your offers coming. Keep the supplies coming. Keep your volunteers coming. They are needed at this time of the greatest challenge we've ever faced with regard to an infectious disease in the state of Texas, or really perhaps globally. Second, I want to go back and emphasize that it's clear from what Dr. Zerwas was talking about that we are fully prepared for the hospital needs of Texans as we continue to respond to the coronavirus in the state of Texas. We have the capacity to add even more beds as are needed in regions that may increase in patient needs. And our capacity should prevent us from facing the type of situation that New York is having to deal with today. Lastly, I want to emphasize that what Dr. Hellerstadt was talking about. Listen, we see that the COVID-19 disease continues to spread in the state of Texas. As a result, we as a state must ensure that everybody in our state is doing everything we possibly can to slow the spread of the coronavirus. What that requires is what everybody's been talking about over the past week, and that is that if you're not involved in providing an essential service in the state of Texas, it is in your best interest for your own life and for your own health for you to stay at home. Staying at home will ensure that you reduce the possibility of you contracting COVID-19. It will reduce the possibility of COVID-19 spreading in the state of Texas. It will ensure that Texas is working to dramatically slow the spread of the disease. Now, I know that this is a strategy that's been in place in different locations for a while, and I know that we are asking you to do this through the remainder of April. That is a tall task to ask you to do that, but we're doing it for your own benefit, for your own health, for your own safety, knowing that between now and the end of April, more lives will be lost because of COVID-19. I want you to make sure that yours is not one of those lives. You have the ultimate control and the ultimate ability to make sure you protect your life. And in doing so, make sure that we slow the spread of the coronavirus in Texas. With that, we'll be happy to take a few questions.
Hey guys, we're going to do one question per person to start, and then we'll go from there. We'll start right here.
Well, the first task that we face and that we're focused on right now is making sure that whether it be hospitals or other healthcare facilities, they have the capacity to deal with COVID-19 patients. Then what we deal with is the tidal wave of financial support that has been delivered from Washington, D.C. There are multiple tranches of funds available to help respond to things like what you're talking about, let's say, lost income by some who are responding to COVID-19. We will get to those as those money tranches begin to come into the state of Texas and once we learn more about exactly how they work. I do know that there is a tranche of funds set aside separately for hospitals in every state, including in the state of Texas. And we'll learn the fine print details about how and under what circumstances those funds can be used. The bottom line is the good news is Washington responded more robustly than ever before in response to anything like this to ensure that hospitals as well as individuals are going to have the capacity to be able to recover from any downturn as a result of COVID-19.
Thank you, Governor. You mentioned how many ventilators we have. Do you know how many we need going forward or might need? And have you asked the federal government to release some of its national stockpile to the state of Texas?
So I'm going to let the doctors answer this, but I'm going to tell you information that I have, which is not based upon me being a doctor, but based upon studies that I have seen. Based upon studies and, if you would, prognostications that I have seen, including the one that was issued by the University of Washington that has been utilized by Dr. Birx at the White House, is that it looks as though Texas should have the capability of being able to provide ventilators as the need may arise. That said, we need to understand a couple of things. One is that we're dealing with a very unknown and uncertain facts about where we may be. As a result, as we speak, we have people and teams working on strategies to increase our ability to bring in even more ventilators, having seen exactly what New York is going through. New York is going through a situation where they may have thought they had enough ventilators, but they needed more. And so we're trying to get ahead of the game, making sure that we will have more than enough ventilators to address the needs of Texans. Now, again, that's based upon studies that I've seen. I would like to turn over to the doctors for them to provide their answers. We'll go with Dr. Hellerstedt first and then Dr. Zerwas.
I agree with the governor. We have lots of ventilators. Don't forget that this is a future that we can control with the kind of activities that we're engaging in right now. So the things that we're doing in terms of social distancing, hygiene, cleanliness and sanitation of our environment, and we see people practicing this everywhere, all over the state, that can alter the course of what the future is like, and that can decrease the demand for those ventilators to the point where at any point in time, anybody who needs hospital care or needs to be in an ICU or on a ventilator, there'll be plenty to go around. So yes, preparation of the kind that you've seen that is very extraordinary and unprecedented is absolutely necessary. We need to be prepared, but we can alter that future. We can shape that future by the kind of preventive measures that are part of the policies that the governor has articulated in his executive orders, and then the behaviors that we see all around us.
Right. I would just say I think I feel very comfortable about where we are in terms of the whole ventilation devices that we have in our inventory right now. We do have more that are on the horizon to come. And I would just say it's also during crises that you see some great ingenuity arise and some things that have been done to try to create some very simple devices, but very effective devices that can actually be produced fairly quickly and at a pretty low cost. So I think we're going to be in a good place. We're fortunate that we're seeing what's going on elsewhere across the world and in our own country, and it has given us that opportunity to, as the commissioner has said, to incorporate these practices that I believe is going to blunt the curve significantly, and with that, hopefully blunt any extraordinary need that we're going to have for ventilation devices. But I feel good about where we are with that. But I also know that we plan for the worst, and then we'll, get some more on board here just in case we need to add some.
So in summation, we start ahead of the curve, but we are sprinting to stay ahead of the curve.
Hi, Governor, thank you. Having all these beds is definitely something very important for preparation, but I know that a lot of healthcare workers
So there are multiple strands that we look at as it concerns the supply chain. One is for PPE, the other is for hospital beds, the other is for personnel and staff. And again, that is an issue that Dr. Zerwas has been working on. So I would like to have him respond to your question.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all these beds and things that we can create don't matter if you can't put somebody there to actually take care of them and stuff. And the rurals are somewhat of a challenge. There's no doubt about that. We're very, very focused on wanting to keep the rurals up and running. But when somebody does get knocked down by contracting the illness and so forth, then we have to look at being able to have a pipeline of people that could come in and help. And so we've been working on that along with the whole inventory of beds. You know, it's bed surge, but it's also manpower surge. And so we've created, there was a Texas.gov website that was created to solicit volunteers to participate in the crisis. The Department of State Health Services already had one of those in place, and so we merged them, and there's been a very, very robust response to that. And so what we're doing on the other side of this now is trying to connect facilities up with potential volunteers. And that's the part that we're testing right now, is to make sure when, you know, the hospital, that has a need, as you just articulated, can reach out and see, okay, does that work? Is that going to result in somebody being available? And so a great deal of our effort right now is, in fact, developing a very, very robust pipeline of volunteers. Or professionals that just retired for whatever reason, you know, and decided they want to come back in. The governor passed a waiver that would allow these licenses to be reinstated and put them back in the profession for the next several months or weeks of this crisis.
Dr. Hellerstedt, you want to offer anything, or Nim?
I think Dr. Zerwas said it all. It's absolutely true that we need those professionals to keep the care flowing. And we do have a plan to be able to particularly add volunteers to that mix.
The volunteers are a tremendous source, and there have been so many people volunteer their services. And some of these people understand this, and that is because elective surgeries are now not allowed. There are a lot of doctors and nurses who are idle right now, who are available to assist. Some may be in that region. Some may be in other regions. A strategy that we have available to us is, let's say that there are an abundance of doctors and nurses in the Dallas area or some other urban area that are not in that rural area. We have access to hotel and motel rooms in those other areas that we can occupy for weeks upon time to accommodate those doctors and nurses who may be able to be mobilized out there. We're also in the process of assessing the capabilities of the members of the current National Guard who have the capability of providing nursing care or any other type of medical care to assist in those types of situations.
I'll add just one other part on this. When you saw the map kind of divided up into those different pieces of puzzle pieces and so forth, those are actually, you know, functional areas. And one of the things that a hospital would do is to reach out to that functional area, one of the regional advisory councils, or to the hospital preparedness program, and say, hey, we've got somebody down, we need some help here. That would be one of the first places you would go to kind of get access to that, and then that council, that group body, would be able to help you with that.
What are specific facilities here in Austin, Central Texas, that you have identified as possible places? Should we get to level one of the research facilities plan?
Well, I mean, it's a work in progress. We've identified a hotel. I wish I could remember the name of it, but I can't. But it's actually been identified and reviewed and is considered to be suitable for taking care of patients on the lower end, either early on and when they're having early evidence of disease, but not enough support that they would need to be in a hospital, or on the tail end where they seem to be getting better and they're convalescing and they just need a little bit more help in terms of completing that that recovery and stuff. But places that we do look to sometimes is some big open areas. The military is very good about coming in and setting up in those types of locations. Convention centers work very well for that type of a thing, and all those things are kind of being assessed right now.
So one thing, and I'll let you, why don't you go ahead, Nim?
The other thing is, that's a conversation that I've also had with the county judge here and your local public health authority, Dr. Escott. And between the judge and their health authority, they really need to be the ones to determine which facilities would be used first. Our job is to help them find those locations and help find staff if needed. But Judge Eckhart and Dr. Escott would be the ones to answer your specific questions about where are they looking right now in Austin and Travis County.
So to follow up on both of those, our first strategy is to look at what Dr. Zerwas was talking about earlier, and that is expansion internally within a hospital facility or a facility that is similar to a hospital-type setting. And many of those have been identified. Separate from that, along the lines of what they're talking about, we did establish our first location in the state of Texas for what I'll call an ancillary facility in the K. Bailey Hutchison Convention Center in Dallas, where the United States Army Corps of Engineers worked with the National Guard to set that up. I was impressed and really stunned in a way how quickly they were able to set that up, already capable of having 250 beds in there, even though it's not needed right now, with the capacity to expand that facility up to 2,500 beds almost immediately. What both Dr. Zerwas and Nim were talking about, and that is, as we speak, the United States Army Corps of Engineers is working with the National Guard, going to other regions around the state of Texas to identify similar locations in those regions in the event that we need to expand beyond the walls of existing healthcare facilities. Well, we, as governors, we remain in conversations with the CDC, with the president, the vice president, Dr. Birx, Dr. Fauci, as well as CDC advisors. And we will have an upcoming telephone conference with them where they bring us up to date on where we are going. So we look forward to hearing from them about that conversation, about what their thoughts are, what maybe their requests are. And we'll respond to their requests or thoughts at the time they articulate them. As I understand it, it's still a process in work right now.
Yes.
More is coming. I'm going to have Nim answer this. I'm recalling from what I think you said that Texas may be number one in the nation in those drive-through facilities. So why don't you let him know what you know? And
yes, sir, that's correct. When we were in the planning phases with the Health and Human Services, and this was really before FEMA was even involved in the drive-through lanes, they said they could support six sites in Texas. We worked with our local officials to first identify the sites, but then Harris County and Houston decided they wanted to split their two sites into four sites. And San Antonio offered up sites to Austin and El Paso out of their site. So you have about 10 different lanes across the state right now that are on the federal funding side. Based on information I received yesterday afternoon from FEMA, Texas is leading the nation in the number of lanes, as well as the number of tests that are being administered through those lanes. But I think the other piece is you've asked about Tarrant County and others. We're seeing almost a doubling now of the federally funded or supported lanes coming out of our local government partners and our private sector pieces. And I really think that's where we're going to get the biggest growth or the largest bang in this case, is by continuing to support that mission instead of just the federally funded lanes. I think at some point the feds have announced that they plan to withdraw their staff so they can shift them to other missions. So eventually we will see only locally supported lanes, that the state will continue our best to operate with PPE supplies and test results.
If I could explain this and understand this kind of structure of the way that it works, there are three primary providers of tests. There are public health authorities, the leader of which is Dr. Hellestet statewide, but you have those public health authorities at the local level also. Separate from those local public health authorities that provide testing, you have the FEMA-provided testing that you were talking about. I would estimate right now, and Doctor, you can weigh in mathematically on this, but either right now, but definitely in the future, the primary provider of all the testing that will be taking place will be through the private healthcare sector. I mentioned earlier these Abbott lab tests, for example. They're all going directly to hospitals for testing, and not going through FEMA, not going through public health. And those 20,000 per week will continue to go to that hospital setting as opposed to public health authorities. In addition to that, remember that in addition to the FEMA designed drive-through testing facilities, there are many others, many other drive-through testing facilities that are provided by private hospitals. There's one, I think, here in Austin, as well as in other locations, provided by Baylor Scott & White, as just one example. I know other hospitals are doing that also. But also, because of the increased testing and collection production capabilities that are being provided to doctors and hospitals, there will be much greater access for collection and testing for the coronavirus at your primary care physician or other healthcare providers. But, Doctor, did you want to add any more to that?
I think you covered it, Governor. Okay. Again, my message is that the testing is an important part of public health. It's what we call surveillance, so we kind of know where the disease is and in our communities and how fast it's spreading. But the key part is prevention, and we should all be practicing those preventive measures right now. So the social distancing, people probably can't see everybody in this room, but everybody's pretty well spread apart. That's a great practice. Those personal hygiene habits and cleaning and disinfecting surfaces. Those are the things that actually prevent the spread of the disease in our community. And that's the thing we want to achieve. We want to slow it down so that all of the things that we prepared for, we are well within the limits of what we have, the capacities that we have in order to take care of people. So yes, testing has its place. Maybe I'm wearing a public health hat when I say that to me, the important piece of it is surveillance, to know what the trends of the disease are in our community. But please, let's not forget that the primary thing we want to do is prevent and slow the spread of COVID-19 in our state, and we are doing that.
If I could just add one thing that the doctor has taught me well, and that is that everybody seems like they want to have access to a test. And for everyone who tests negative, that's good for that day and that day only, because you could be negative today but contract it tomorrow. And so as the doctor is trying to emphasize, our goal from testing is to first and foremost provide protection and identification to the healthcare providers who have to confront this every single day, but also to identify those who do test positive so they can be isolated so they don't cause anybody else to contract the coronavirus.
I think the William Beaumont Hospital is what I think I was given from the folks that were up there, and would add some substantial capacity. What I understand is it's actually been completed. It's brand new, but it just hasn't been brought up and made operational yet and stuff. And so that's what I was referring to, was one of the folks from one of the healthcare systems up there shared that with me.
So. Okay. Well, if I heard correctly, your question concerns vote by mail? Yeah. And so there were maybe elections scheduled for May. And I haven't checked the news today, but it seems like most of the elections that were set for May have been rescheduled for a later date, as an example. And that is, I, by executive order, moved the primary runoff date from May to July. There were many municipal elections set for in early May that have been moved to a later date. It may be that all of the elections that were set to take place in May were set for a later date. And so we have, not just by tradition, but by law, allow people to vote in person. And we want to be able to fulfill what the law provides of allowing people to vote in person, if at all possible. And by moving the date, it hopefully will achieve what the law provides, and that is that people can vote in person.
Paul. Yeah, of the PPE that you've asked for in the national stockpile, how much has Texas actually obtained? Is it a third of what you've asked for, a quarter? And we have an idea. And as we sit here today, going forward, do you consider the feds to be a viable source in the supply chain for what Texas needs?
Sure. The man in charge of that is Nim Kidd. I'll let him answer first, then I may add on to it.
Yeah. So, Paul, if I understood your question, from what we've asked for from FEMA, what have we received? the easy, quick answer is what we've received right now is about 3.8 million masks across the board of what we received. It was a lot larger number that we asked for, but really when we started quantifying that number, I don't know that I could draw two numbers together to tell you why we asked for that number. That seemed to be the best guess at the time of what we might need. I can tell you that we continue to work with them and push through with that, and they have delivered what they have been able to as best they've been able to. And I'm going back to the now looking at what do we do next, and that is to continue to put product back in the normal supply chain. And I think what we will all see as a nation over these next coming weeks as FEMA establishes the air bridge to resupply America is we will see that government less asking for or supplying to the private sector and more of the way it was traditionally the private sector providing for the private sector. And I think we're just going to have to work together to watch as that needle starts to move from government buying and government making and giving to public or private hospitals to those public and private hospitals working with their private sector providers once that supply chain is reestablished.
So I'll add to that, and that is in the short few weeks that we've been working on this, we've seen a massive alteration in the supply chain where, as opposed to states being reliant upon the federal government, we've seen multiple opportunities arise through the private sector that the state is able to tap into, and that we will be able to receive an increasing percentage of our supplies from the private sector. But understand this, our capability to tap into those supplies is enhanced because of the massive funds that are flowing from Washington, D.C. To Texas to ensure that all of our needs are going to be met for all challenges concerning COVID-19.
Yeah. Point of clarification first. When you mentioned these hospitalizations at previous conferences, are those cumulative hospitalizations so far, or is that currently the number of people who are hospitalized and not also testing positive for coronavirus? We've heard some local numbers that suggest the hospitalization statewide pretty much.
Yeah, let me tell you what the number is and tell you where the numbers come from, and so we can try to match up numbers. What I have as of today is hospitalizations in the state of Texas that have a relation to COVID-19 is 827. Let's go back in time. About a week ago and before that time, numbers that I were giving to you were numbers that came from public health authorities. Since that time, we've been adding in numbers that come from private providers, such as all the hospitals around the states. And so the 827 that I have as of today is the aggregation of public health authorities and the information that we have received from hospitals across the state. It's the most cumulative information we have. That's what I was going to say. Let me open this up to the Dr. Hellerstedt or anybody else who wants to weigh in and provide more clarity.
Well, you're right, Governor. We are working on ways to make sure that we capture all of the information that we need in terms of COVID-19-related hospitalizations. So that is something that we're trying to develop so we have the most accurate picture at any point in time.
No, I would just point out that, even with those hospitalizations, if you look at the capacity that we have built into the system right now, we're certainly incredibly well prepared to see any kind of uptick in that. Whether it goes up from this number to 1,000, 1,200, whatever that might be. Yeah, we're certainly in a good position to deal with that.
Put me down as keenly interested, and I will look into it, but I'm going to let Dr. Hellerstedt answer first.
Absolutely. So the question was about measuring people's antibodies to COVID-19 virus, or technically it's the SARS-CoV-2 virus in particular. And we know that when people get infections, part of the normal immune response is to start to form antibodies against that particular virus. And so there are people out there, companies, research that are finding ways to measure those antibodies. What we call a titer, the amount of the antibody that's present in the person. So what happens is you get an infection, you fight it off, you form an immune response to it. part of the immune response that you have to it is antibody formation. And so what we're trying to do is there's two different aspects to this. One is the technical and the medical aspect of it. When we measure, are we really measuring the antibodies against COVID, or rather SARS-CoV-2 virus, and not perhaps some related coronavirus? So how specific is it to that? How sensitive is it to that? And then if we have that, does the formation of antibodies, what does it tell us actually about the person's immunity status? So in some cases, you may form antibodies, and those antibodies may fade away at a point in time, in which case the immunity isn't long-lasting. In other cases, the immunity is very robust and can last for a very long time, and they're quite protective. That's the scientific question that we're still trying to investigate. But in going back to looking at the assays themselves, we want to make sure that they're sensitive, in other words, they pick them up, and that they're specific, to the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And those, the answers to those things will help us to understand how we can actually use this test. So one of the things that I think you alluded to is to say, hey, if we went and tested a bunch of people out there and found that there was a whole lot more antibody formation than we knew about before, maybe we would say to ourselves that there's a larger pool of people who actually have immunity to COVID-19 than we measured through testing the infection itself. And that would also be very valuable information. We'd love to know, as time goes on, who has formed immunity to COVID-19, because that would be very helpful. Those folks shouldn't be able to get the virus again, we hope, and they shouldn't be able to pass it on to others, so that starts to build up, I hate to use the word herd immunity, but it's something along the idea of herd immunity. The more people that we know have become immune to it, the better we're going to be able to plan our public health strategies.
Very good.
Hello, this is Michael, continuing to read state and national articles from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Friday, April 3rd. From the front page, energy. Trump says he expects Russia and Saudis to cut production. By Arab Batre and Kathy Buswites, Associated Press, Dubai. President Donald Trump said Thursday he expects Saudi Arabia and Russia will dramatically cut production and end an oil war that sent energy prices to record lows. But the Kremlin disputed part of his tweet, leading to skepticism that a deal was imminent. A global glut in production, coupled with an economy reeling from the coronavirus pandemic, has sent energy prices to lows not seen since 2002. Trump tweeted Thursday that he had spoken with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman just days after talking to Russian President Vladimir Putin about the matter. Trump tweeted, "I expect and hope that they will be cutting back approximately 10 million barrels and maybe substantially more, which, if it happens, will be great for the oil and gas industry." He also tweeted that Prince Mohammed bin Salman had spoken with Putin and later tweeted the presumed production cut could be as high as 15 million barrels. But Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Putin and the prince have not spoken recently. "No, there wasn't such a conversation," he said, according to Russian state news agency TASS. Nevertheless, U.S. benchmark crude climbed more than 20% Thursday after Trump's tweet. Even with those gains, prices are down 60% from the start of the year. Saudi Arabia called for an urgent meeting of OPEC and non-OPEC producers Thursday, just weeks after triggering the price war with Russia that sent oil prices plummeting. Russia's refusal last month to extend and deepen production cuts with OPEC and its de facto leader, Saudi Arabia, sparked immediate backlash from Riyadh, where oil policy is largely dictated by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The kingdom slashed oil prices last month and vowed to ramp up production to more than 12 million barrels a day. The clash is taking place during a period of vastly reduced energy demand. The pandemic arrived with the global economy entering a cycle of slower growth. The confluence has pushed Brent crude oil prices to below $30 a barrel, far below what Saudi Arabia or Russia need to balance their budgets. The price of U.S. crude fell harder than at any point in history, plunging more than 65% to around $20 per barrel, lower than what many U.S. shale companies can withstand. In a statement carried on the state-run Saudi press agency Thursday, the kingdom said its call for a meeting of major oil producers indicates the country's support for the global economy at this time and is in appreciation of Trump and the request made by the United States. It said the purpose of calling a meeting is aimed at reaching a fair agreement to restore balance in the oil market. The state-run news agency in Saudi Arabia noted that a call took place between Trump and the Crown Prince, but made no mention of Trump's specific oil and gas companies' executives Friday. There is skepticism over an international deal, however. There's going to be resistance from all parties to making a cutback that's really going to make a difference, said Michael Lynch, president of Strategic Energy and Economic Research. Trump's engagement could persuade Saudi Arabia, if not the Kremlin, to relent, said Kevin Book, managing director at Clearview Energy Partners. But an agreement to reduce output by 10 million or 15 million barrels per day would likely require U.S. cuts too, he said. One oil industry regulator in Texas, Ryan Sitton, has been discussing the possibility of prorating production in his state, although a formal proposal hasn't been made. I need to be at least talking about what that might look like, Sitton said in an interview. If the president were to step into a deal or step into negotiations and help get a deal done, if I can give him a tool to bring to the table, then I'd like to explore it. Low crude prices make many drilling operations in the U.S. unsustainable, and in response, companies have announced thousands of layoffs and furloughs. At the same time, for most consumers, falling oil prices can be a blessing. Some stations are selling gasoline for less than $1 a gallon, though the national average is closer to $2, and many Americans staying home won't see a benefit from low gas prices. Trump to meet with oil executives by Ari Natter, Jennifer Lowy, and Kevin Crawley, Bloomberg. Oil company executives, reeling from a massive drop in prices, are set to meet with President Donald Trump today as the administration seeks ways to help the beleaguered industry. The meeting, which was confirmed by the American Petroleum Institute, comes just as Saudi Arabia unleashes a record volume of crude into the already glutted global oil market, escalating a price war with Russia. Trump, who once hailed the unprecedented plunge in oil prices as a tax cut for American consumers, has stepped up efforts in recent days to intervene as the route threatens to wipe out tens of thousands of jobs in America's shale patch. "We don't want to lose our great oil companies," Trump said Wednesday during a briefing at the White House. The president said he expects the two countries to settle their differences. He also said he's planning to meet with independent oil producers in addition to the majors. "They're negotiating, they're talking, and I think they'll come up with something," Trump said. "I do believe there's a way that that can be solved, or pretty well solved." Executives from companies such as ExxonMobil Corporation, Chevron Corporation, Occidental Petroleum Corporation, and Continental Resources Incorporated are expected to attend, according to people familiar with the meeting, who asked not to be named to discuss non-public matters. Among the topics expected to be discussed are possible tariffs on oil imports into the U.S. from Saudi Arabia, and relief from the Jones Act that requires ships that transport goods from between U.S. ports to be American flagged, according to one of the people familiar. Representatives of the White House did not immediately comment. Attendees represent companies across the oil industry, including independent producers such as Continental and Devon Energy Corporation. At least one midstream pipeline operator, Energy Transfer Partners, and one refiner, Phillips 66, according to another person familiar with the meeting. representatives of the American Petroleum Institute are also attending the meeting. No independent offshore oil producers were invited to the summit, and no European oil majors, even those with substantial U.S. operations, are invited. So Royal Dutch Shell, PLC, BP, PLC, Equinor, ASA, and others are left out. The companies have advanced widely varying prescriptions for dealing with the glut of crude fed by the Russia-Saudi oil price war and collapsing demand from the coronavirus. Oil majors such as Exxon and Chevron, for instance, have typically opposed any kind of government intervention in crude markets, including tariffs and mandated production cuts. With better access to capital and diversification of businesses, they're more resilient than smaller operators to ride out the rout. But some U.S. independent explorers, whose tenacity and technological innovation began the shale oil revolution, argue that such low crude prices risk killing America's domestic industry, leaving the country dependent on foreign producers once again. Continental Resources Chairman Harold Hamm has urged the U.S. impose tariffs on Saudi and Russian crude, while several oil industry trade groups and refiners have warned against that step. The American Petroleum Institute has asked the White House to find a diplomatic solution. The American Exploration and Production Council previously floated the Jones Act waiver. Natural gas and oil will be critical to our nation's economic recovery, and the industry's message to the administration is sharing actions it is taking during this challenging time and highlighting that history has proven that markets work, the American Petroleum Institute said in an emailed statement. We are not seeking any government subsidies or industry-specific intervention to address the recent market downturn at this time. Texas Railroad Commissioner Ryan Sitton says Trump should offer that the U.S. cut production at home for matching reductions from Saudi Arabia and Russia. Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or your favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.